The unprecedented 2020 presidential election will be the most consequential in a generation. Who becomes the next U.S. president has huge implications on the direction of the country in the next 4 years. What kind of presidential leadership we need during turbulent times? What lessons can we learn from past crises? I spoke with Margaret O'Mara, history professor at the University of Washington, on presidential leadership.
Hi, Professor O'Mara. Thanks for joining the AmCham podcast. The U.S. now faces a triple whammy. We have the biggest health crisis in a century, the biggest economic decline since the Great Depression, and we have rising racial tension as well. Drawn from historical perspectives, what are the similarities and differences between the current challenges we face today and the turbulent times that we had to deal with in the past?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, you can look at the year 2020 is as if you have the year 1918 of the influenza pandemic and the end of World War One, plus 1929, the stock market crash and the Great Depression, plus, 1965 in Selma, or 1968, the sort of racial violence, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and more. So, and we had a presidential election on top of it. It's just, it's information overload. It's a lot for the world to cope with, and certainly the American electoral system to cope with. But I think the electoral system is a reflection of our society, as it always has been. But I think history does give us, we can't predict. The one thing that historians know is that any sort of dissection of the meaning of a presidential election the day after it happens, or even the meaning of a extraordinary year of crisis, mm-hmm. while it's still happening, is very difficult. You know, we don't quite know what the verdict of history will be, because the story is still moving. I think when we do look backwards and look at these past moments, we can see patterns that I think are useful, very instructive for business, instructive for political leaders, for civic leaders. So take, for example, the influenza pandemic of 1918. I think that's one example, a very powerful example of kind of what leaders do and do not do, mm-hmm. Makes a tremendous difference. There was a great deal of, most leaders worldwide kind of tried to downplay the influenza pandemic, didn't recognize what it was yet, partially because the First World War was ongoing, but also because of fear of disease, of denial. Denial is a very powerful human instinct. Mm-hmm. And is one reason that it became known as the Spanish flu, because the leaders of Spain were the only ones who acknowledged its first ones to acknowledge its existence. Probably came from the United States. Woodrow Wilson was really didn't, you know, does not win any medals for how he handled the influenza pandemic. Granted, there wasn't a federal public health infrastructure or a federal government of the size that the United States has now by any means. And it was really up to state and local authorities. But we see this real difference from city to city, both in the United States and worldwide. So I think, leadership, not just a combination of actual kind of taking control of the levers of bureaucracy and making it work for the people is one, but also moral leadership and giving kind of rhetorically and sort of stepping up and giving people something to believe in. I think when we look at 1932, the election that Franklin Roosevelt won, when he beat out a one-term president, Herbert Hoover, I think there are a lot of very interesting parallels, particularly now that it's looking as though Donald Trump will be a one-term American president. And that I think a lot of the dynamics in 2020 really came down to economic dynamics, and that the COVID-19 wasn't as an economic crisis, and there's a great deal of impatience in the United States about the lockdowns, the shutdowns. We have handled it worse than the rest of the world, in part because didn't take it seriously enough, and then have very short attention spans. Everyone's tired of the pandemic. And I think the economic, unlike other nations, the United States did not, you know, gave people some help with small businesses and their jobs as everything shut down. But that really has run out. And so there really isn't economic assistance coming from the public sector that's keeping people from being destitute. And so that, I think, was something that Donald Trump took advantage of as a candidate, saying, I'm going to reopen, you know, well, let's get back to normal. We're turning the corner. And that's what so many Americans want to hear, even many Americans who voted for Joe Biden. So having, you know, but I think you can, you know, the sort of assurances, the empty assurances that Donald Trump has been delivering, which are not reflective with the public health situation, are a real contrast to earlier American presidents, Franklin Roosevelt being one of them. Roosevelt runs in 1932 on a message of hope, but also realism, saying the Great Depression is great, that it is, we are in a very extraordinarily difficult moment, and that, but we can get through it. And this is how we're going to do it. And he continued to do that throughout his presidency. There were plenty of people who didn't like Franklin Roosevelt at all. Every president has been, you know, had his great fans and his great dissenters. But Roosevelt, I think, was extraordinarily effective communicator. He used radio the way Donald Trump uses Twitter.
Fireside chat.
Mm-hmm, fireside chat. Spoke directly to the American public through the radio. And it was very savvy politics, because what he would do is he'd get people to say, you know, write your congressman. Like when the Congress wasn't giving Franklin Roosevelt what he wanted, he would say, oh, go, you know, he'd give a fireside chat, say what the America should do, and encourage people to reach out to their member of Congress and tell them to vote a certain way. It was very, very smart politics. So, but I think that, again, you know, and we've seen this in 2020, where we have world leaders who've been very honest with their constituents about the pandemic itself, the public health crisis, what needs to be done. They've based, you know, public action has been based on science. And you see world leaders being, you know, like Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, reelected with a massive, massive endorsement, whereas Trump is not being reelected. And granted, many, many Americans voted for him. It's a very close election.
We don't know yet, but it looks very likely that Joe Biden is on his path to victory.
That is correct. Yes, it is not. It was at the time of when we're having this conversation, it has not been called. You're absolutely right.
Yes.
The popular vote, which, as those who watch American elections know, actually does not matter, which is one of the really weird things about our system that is in need of reform, if you ask me. The popular vote, Joe Biden's ahead, but a larger margin than Hillary Clinton had, the popular vote. But the Electoral College is not yet decided, although right now it's trending. The path for Joe Biden is much easier than it is for Trump. So, but Trump is contesting these states, a lot of these contests. So may not see the final chapter of the American presidential election this week or even next week, or maybe the week after that. We don't know.
Yes. Well, the election may soon be over, but the work has started already or has been ongoing, because mm-hmm. we're now facing, this is both a health crisis and mm-hmm. an economic crisis. Mm-hmm. And if Joe Biden were to win the presidency, what does he need to accomplish in his first 100 days in office to address, you know, the biggest concern being COVID-19, of course, and mm-hmm. also economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're interrelated, of course, right? So this is different from the crisis of the 1930s, which was a collapse of markets.
Yes.
And world markets have been hit this year, not because of their own collapse, but because of the crisis of the pandemic. So his, you know, what he needs to do, I think the first order of business is to have a much more comprehensive federalized COVID-19 response that involves medication, a vaccine program, but also testing. And simply, you know, what we've learned over the course of this pandemic is the things that were used in 1918 are the best preventative cures of all, right? And something that people in Hong Kong, for example, that have been very aware of for quite some time, which is to wear a mask all the time.
Yes.
And social distancing and washing your hands. These are the things that people did in 1918. And they're, you know, this is what we need to do now. And giving American institutions like public schools the resources to reopen safely, which is going to be an expenditure of money and a great logistical operation that really the Trump administration has abdicated. So if Joe Biden is to win and he does take office in January, I think you're going to see a very, very different approach or an effort to make that. I think a big, what is really going to make all the difference is Congress. So, right, the other thing that's going on as we're having this conversation is that the U.S. Senate looks like it's on track to for the Republicans to retain a very slim majority. We may not know that for sure for another month or so because it involves some runoff elections. If there is a Republican control of Congress, it's going to be much harder for Joe Biden to get an agenda of any kind forward. There's going to be a lot of resistance for the sake of resistance to what he's doing. That is the tactic that Mitch McConnell employed very successfully with Barack Obama in 2009. And we'll do so again, but we don't know yet. So that's going to be one thing. But I think that there's, I would hope, and I believe that there is a bipartisan consensus that there does need to be some better governance of the pandemic response. The kind of, you know, Mitch McConnell is someone who's sort of on the record saying everyone should be wearing masks all the time. Like, I think, you know, we'd see something perhaps like a national mask mandate, which is something that Joe Biden has proposed that he would do.
Yes.
These things are not radical changes in other parts of the world. For the United States, this would be a huge step forward because we now have this very, very uneven application of controls. And this is, of course, economic policy. So people are, even in states where things have opened up, people are not going back to patronize restaurants and businesses because they're scared. And you aren't seeing revenue coming. You know, we're not going to see business come back until this thing is under control and people have confidence again. So but I would imagine that, you know, what a Biden administration would want to do. I think Biden has been studying a lot of his Franklin Roosevelt. I get the sense. It's one reason that I've made a point to, you know, I'm spending a lot of time reading and writing about revisiting some of the things I've written about Roosevelt myself, because I think it's very relevant. And I imagine that Biden is going to be talking about that a lot. And that may, you know, and really what Roosevelt was about was Keynesian economics. It was harnessing the power of government to stimulate the economy at scale. And to, so, you know, ideally, I would imagine that that would be what the Democrats would want to do if they had control of both Congress and the White House, is a much more ambitious program for economic stimulus that would involve supporting people who are unemployed, helping small businesses stay afloat until we get the virus under control, investing heavily in school reopenings, things and childcare. You know, I mean, school itself, of course, is childcare for working parents. It's another, all these things are necessary to get the economy going again. You right now have a lot of people working at home with children also learning at home. And for those with young children, that has been a huge, huge productivity hit. And a lot of parents, particularly women, have left the workforce.
So back in 2008, we also had a major global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. But Barack Obama became the first African-American to be elected president of the United States at a time of great economic uncertainty. But his change campaign message resonated a lot of the American people and united the country. Mm-hmm. Now, fast forward to 2016, Donald Trump pulled off one of the biggest political upsets in U.S. history by winning the presidency despite having less popular votes. Mm-hmm. Since then, the country has become so divided under his administration. Mm-hmm. We have division between the rural and urban areas, division between voters with college degrees and voters who don't have a college degree, and so on. Mm-hmm. What happened to the soul of America, and what went wrong?
Well, strangely enough, some of the same impulses, believe it or not, the interest in change and starting anew and doing something very different fueled both Obama's election in 2008 and Trump's election in 2016. They were both anti-establishment candidates in different ways. Obama, because he was this young guy who hadn't been in politics for decades and decades. He was Black. He was an incredible public speaker and able to connect with people, and also George W. Bush was incredibly unpopular. And the Republicans, you know, the combination of the Iraq War and then the financial crisis really made it very difficult for John McCain, who was running as the Republican candidate that year, to win against Obama. But the same thing happened in 2016, and Trump, for all of his, his whole political career was based on kind of tearing down Barack Obama. You know, he kind of launched himself into politics in a big way by fostering this, lie about Obama's country birthplace, and that he was not born in the United States, which of course you have to be born in the United States to be president. It was a complete lie. It was very racist. It was pandering to everyone's worst instincts. But Trump's whole governing philosophy has really been not a particular ideology, but just let me undo everything Barack Obama did. But with all that being said, Trump was very, very similar to Obama in that he was an outsider. He did not represent the establishment of either party. He is tapping into people's dissatisfaction with the status quo, with the economic status quo, people feeling like they've been left behind, feeling like the elites of both parties are sitting in their kind of coastal cities in San Francisco and New York and Seattle and kind of doing their thing and not thinking about the real lived reality of the American working class and lower middle class. There's been a real failure on the part of both parties. The Democrats, who used to be the party of the working class, and still are to some degree and still profess to be, but has not really addressed problems of the kind of economic hollowing out of parts of the country, in part because they're very difficult to fix. But there really is a failure of imagination and leadership. So Obama's kind of coming in as this fresh face, and Trump's coming in as this fresh face. And Hillary Clinton, she was the first woman of a major party nominee who's a woman. Mm-hmm. And so kind of positioned herself as a change candidate, right? You would think, this is, groundbreaking in the way that Obama was groundbreaking. But she was not the candidate of change. She was the candidate of the political establishment. Hillary Clinton had been a familiar face in American politics for, a quarter century. She had, been First Lady of the United States. She had been Secretary of State. She had she was of those elite coastal circles. That was her world. And that was something, and she was also someone who throughout her life as a public person had been someone who had been kind of a subject of attack by conservative attack, and also by, a lot of voters, kind of did not like who she was as a political wife, nor as who she was as a candidate. And it's a kind of a very kind of complex and nuanced type of misogyny. It was something that was very, I think it's sort of an anti-Hillary Clinton sentiment that had to do with her. But she really represented the old guard, and Trump was new. And so for people who were like, well, I voted for, Democrats and Republicans, and I'm still here in this, industrial town, and my job, keeps on paid less and less and less, and now it's gone away. What the heck? What do I have to lose? Let me just, this guy, and the guy's a businessman. Trump was had kind of created this celebrity aura around himself as this savvy businessman, and people voted for that. And they voted for it again. I think his rule breaking that continues to not only offend people, but actually does break laws, to be very clear, that we've never had a president like this. And to normalize his behavior is kind of acknowledging that, in a way you weaken the institutions if you sort of say that this is okay, and it's okay if you do all the things that Trump does and get away with it. It's not okay. But the fact that he has been such a rule-breaking president has been like, I don't care. I'm going to hire my kids. Like, I'm going to keep on, promoting my business. I'm going to do this, that, and the other. Like, and that, again, he's in a way, he's made him maintained his status as the change candidate, but also has alienated enough people that people who voted for, we don't know yet what the patterns are going to be, how many people switched from voted Trump in 2016 and switched to Biden. But I imagine it's some people, and it's probably could have tipped the balance, particularly in these Rust Belt states like Pennsylvania, if Biden indeed gets Pennsylvania, but Michigan and Wisconsin, which have been called for Biden, that that you know, Biden represents a change as well, which is a change from Trump, kind of let's stop the chaos, let's stop the reality TV show, and let's get back to the sort of leadership that we're used to and kind of a more normal presidency. And I think a lot of Americans are ready for that.
Although Joe Biden represents change, but in a sense that he's been in politics for many, many decades, dating back in 1972 when he first ran for the US Senate and he won. And if you look at the current electoral map, especially in swing states like in Ohio and Florida, actually Donald Trump won by a comfortable margin. That means there are still a lot of supporters Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
When Joe Biden sworn in on January 20th, let's assume that he's going to win the presidency, the Electoral College, what kind of presidential leadership does he need to have to steer the country mm-hmm. out of this multidimensional crisis, mm-hmm. but beyond that, to heal the deep divisions and bring back the country together?
It's going to be a big job. It's going to be a really, really hard job. I think the big surprise of this election has been there was a real difference in the polling of the degree of support there was out there for Biden versus, you know, when you saw the polls last week, it was like, oh, big margins for Biden in all these places. And that hasn't played out the way that it was supposed to. That Biden is, you know, is going to need, one of the things that Trump did that was different from all of his predecessors, both Republicans and Democrats, was that he ran as a candidate for one slice of the electorate and then continued to govern for really one part of America and was sort of had a strategy that was, you know, the other part of America that doesn't like me and didn't vote for me, they're the enemy. And they're not us, you know, they're the blue states. And if coronavirus is hitting New York City, well, that's a blue state problem. You know, the blue state it's not an American problem. This is this really striking contrast to George W. Bush, another Republican, who wins in 2000 after loses the popular vote and wins the Electoral College. And he recognizes that the narrowness and the fact that if you look at a pure popular vote standpoint, the other guy got more votes, that what he needed to do was make a genuine effort to enlarge his constituency, to reach out to people who hadn't voted for him, and make them feel like he was their president too. And, you know, to the degree he was able to do it, I think that, you know, he was embarking on that path when 9/11 happened. And that was a moment of sort of extraordinary moment of national trauma and national unity, where his approval ratings shoot up because people were rallying around needing leadership. And then, you know, they go down over his presidency largely because of the Iraq War and the choices that they made to kind of persuade the United States to go into it and then to continue in it. So Joe Biden is going to have a big job. It's going to be extremely difficult. I actually think, you know, what's really interesting to me is that Americans have liked their presidents to be from outside of Washington pretty much ever since Watergate. So when Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 after the scandal precipitated by the Watergate break-in, you see the next cycle, 1976, you see Jimmy Carter wins by running against Washington. He's like, I'm a farmer from Georgia. I'm the governor of Georgia. I'm not from Washington. I'm not a lawyer. I'm someone who's an outsider. I'm a businessman. And the same thing after, you know, former senators like Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy winning the presidency. Now, after Carter, you see former governors like Ronald Reagan, former governors like Bill Clinton, former governors like George W. Bush, because that's what American voters have liked. In 2020, Joe Biden, you know, the fact that he has this long history in politics seems like less of a liability because of what 2020 has brought us, which is, if anything, I think one takeaway that Americans need to take from this year is that government matters. We need to make government great again, that having people with expertise in government is extraordinarily important. Trump has had, not only has Trump had zero experience before he became president, but he surrounded himself with really, with people who had, I'm going to be honest, have no idea what they're doing. And the kind of initial round of people who kind of came into work with him out of loyalty and who had experience in previous administrations, he got rid of all of them because they weren't going to be yes men. And that's very dangerous because the U.S., the United States, as you all know very well in Hong Kong, the U.S. is an economic and military superpower. And, you know, even Republicans who have been kind of politically not, you know, against big government and have liked taxes to be low and government to be small, have had a respect for the need for expertise, scientific, technological, bureaucratic. You need to know what you're doing to run this massive organization. So Biden's government experience, I think, in that degree has worked in his favor as a candidate and will work in his favor as a president.
So let's now switch gear a little bit to talk about global leadership. Mm-hmm. Because global leadership is equally important in times of global crises. Mm-hmm. With the downturn to domestic issues facing the United States, can the U.S. rise to the occasion and lead by example? And what leadership role can the U.S. play on the global stage in the midst of rising geopolitical competition?
Yeah, I think that's the big question. You know, the U.S. has been a very bad 4 years for U.S. standing in the world. And particularly coming at a moment when China already wasn't a superpower and is becoming more so. And when the U.S. has stepped back and kind of willfully pushed away our allies and close friends around the world and broken alliances, both military and the, you know, Paris Climate Accord and other things that are really critical for a future, you know, collective future, that creates this opening. I think the other thing, you know, when I'm not studying presidents, I write about the history of technology. And, you know, if I look at what China has been doing in terms of high tech and what the public sector in China has invested in, it's as if they looked at what the U.S. did in the 50s and during the Cold War in 50s and 60s and took notes. So they're investing in higher education, in people, investing heavily in advanced technologies, doing this massive investment in infrastructure, social infrastructure, physical infrastructure, cities, all these things. The U.S. used to do that. We don't do that as much anymore. And so that is, you know, you'd say an own goal. Like we're doing this to ourselves. And the other thing the United States is doing that I think distinguished it from nearly every other place in the world and was a critical ingredient in its technological and economic dominance, which is immigration policy. So opening doors so that people from around the world can come to the United States to study, go to graduate school, to start companies, to take jobs, all those things. So you have a huge percentage of the Silicon Valley workforce, the workforce here in Seattle in tech, foreign-born, and you have a disproportionate number of entrepreneurs, people who start businesses in tech and outside of it, who are immigrants or first generation. It's a huge, huge economic engine. And so the policies of the last several years, and also the kind of, not only the policies themselves, but kind of the chilling effect that the whole politics, immigration politics has placed on, you know, I have students who want to come to the University of Washington where I teach from China, from other parts of the world. And they're like, nope, I'm going to go somewhere else. Like I'm going to stay home or I'm going to go to Europe or go to Australia or because it's been made, it's very, very difficult. And so these are things that the U.S. needs to rebuild, that it isn't a matter of kind of trade wars and blocking and walls and keeping things out. It's a matter of rebuilding our own capacity so that we are more competitive and a better partner and a better leader.
Yes, let's make American immigration policy great again.
I agree. Yes, I agree.
And on that note, thank you very much, Professor Omar, for your time.
My pleasure.